Hey guys, welcome to another episode of True Crimes and Weird Times. I'm Ashley.
And I'm Kim.
And today, I'm going to be telling you about the exorcism of Roland Doe, a young boy who was thought to be possessed by demonic forces. But was he really?
And I'll be telling you the story of Christina Kettlewell, a young woman who mysteriously died just 8 days after eloping with her husband.
Doe, which was actually a pseudonym used for this young boy, they didn't use his real name, and we're not 100% sure who he is, was born into a German Lutheran family in Cottage City, Maryland. He was an only child, and, you know, as an only child, he sought friends from the adults around him.
I mean, my kid does the same thing. He's an only child. Yep. His best friends are like his grandparents.
Yeah. But one of those friends was his Aunt Harriet, who was probably considered like the cool aunt.
Everybody has a cool aunt.
Everybody has a cool aunt. Well, she was a spiritualist. She claimed to communicate with the dead. And she was actually the one who introduced Roland to a Ouija board when he showed interest in it at one time.
Okay.
So she's like, yeah, I'll show you. Let's talk to the dead.
Yeah. Normal things to do for children in the 40s.
What are they going to do? Now, when Roland's Aunt Harriet died when he was 14, the family began to start experiencing some really weird things going on. Well, first of all, Roland allegedly took his aunt's death very hard. It was somebody he looked up to. And he actually started using a Ouija board to try to communicate with her.
Okay.
Now, some sources said this is probably where everything began.
I mean, it would make sense.
Yeah, as stories do with Ouija boards. In January of 1949, the family began to hear, like, strange scratching noises through the house. I mean, they originally thought maybe it was an animal infestation. They even called exterminators to come out and take care of it. There was obviously nothing. But then it kind of started moving on to other strange noises. Furniture started moving. His bed would shake. Objects would fly or levitate anytime Roland was around. Then by February, there were also claims of words starting to appear underneath Roland's skin.
Like underneath his skin?
Like scratched onto his skin.
Oh.
So, and he would start displaying unnatural strength and episodes of just cursing and screaming and just outbursts.
Mm-hmm.
So, by that time, the family's like, okay, well, maybe he's possessed by a demon.
I mean, yeah. pretty easy conclusion to come to, I'd say.
I would think so. So the family first got in touch with their pastor, Pastor Schultz. And now he was interested in parapsychology. This got his attention. Hey, something weird's going on. He had arranged for Roland to spend the night in his home so he can kind of see what's going on. He claimed to see furniture moving, objects moving. I guess since this was out of the realm of his
expertise,
yeah. He advised them to, like, seek out the Catholic Church for help. Or it could have just been like, not for me. This is too close.
Yeah.
you can go to them.
I didn't expect this to be real. It's your turn.
Now, first, he was taken to Georgetown University for observation for mental illness. I was surprised by this.
I am too.
Yeah. Doctors came in and out. He was there for several days. They couldn't come up with any medical reason that Roland was experiencing these things or like all these things are happening to him. They couldn't offer any treatments. However, I feel like they might have, isn't this like the time of lobotomies or something?
Yeah.
I feel like maybe something like that should have happened. But after this is when the Catholic Church kind of stepped in. And they conducted their own formal investigation on Roland to determine whether this was actually demonic possession. Now, the Catholic Church didn't take this stuff very lightly. Like, this isn't something they were just throwing out. Here's an exorcism. You get an exorcism. You get an exorcism.
Yeah, they had very strict, like, guidelines about what classified as a possession, right?
Right. So, they went on to actually conduct an exorcism on Roland. So this is something they truly believed was going on. Father Albert Hughes volunteered to conduct an exorcism. Now, the thing about Albert Hughes is that he was a younger priest. Typically, they like to use more seasoned priests who are older, been through some things, can take the time to, you know, do it right.
Mm-hmm.
But Father Hughes was convinced that he was up to the task, he could do it.
I feel like he's not going to be up to the task.
According to the story, no. So during this exorcism, just as Father Hughes began to recite the ritual, Roland had somehow slipped out of his restraints and broke a bed spring from the bed and slashed at the priest. Now he got him right in the shoulder and allegedly like all the way down to his wrist.
Wow.
Yeah. And apparently the wound needed like over 100 stitches.
Wow.
Yeah. Also, according to the story, Father Hughes had like a nervous breakdown and resigned from the assignment, which that might be enough for me. I don't know. The Catholic diocese, with the family's permission, then transferred Roland to the Alexian Brothers Hospital, which is just outside St. Louis, Missouri, for yet another exorcism. Now, this time, Father William Bodern was assigned to exorcise Roland, and he had help from two other priests. Now, assisting Father Bodern was Raymond J. Bishop and Walter Halloran. Now, from what I read, Father Halloran was there to just kind of take notes. I mean, he was assisting in the exorcism, but, I mean, he made notes. He has a diary. Bodern has a diary of, like, the events, if you want to look them up online. And Father Bishop was there to help restrain Roland during the exorcism, but they were all three present. Father Bodern was a more mature priest, you know, kind of following the guidelines. He spent time studying and praying and fasting ahead of time, per the Catholic guidelines for exorcisms. And I say that to kind of compare him to the first exorcism that didn't go so well.
Where he's just like, I got this.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Just kidding. Maybe this is, you know, why they pick the more seasoned priests to do this. It was said that Roland was mostly calm and quiet during the day, but at night, the priest would find scratches and words on the boy's skin, you know, the shaking bed again, objects flying through the room, and Roland started having these outbursts with guttural voices.
Ooh.
Also speaking Latin at times. I mean, you know, the full possession stereotype.
Yeah.
I mean, it's happening. So these priests were performing the exorcist rite, like, every night up until April. Like, he ended up at the Alexian Brothers Hospital in March, and they were reciting this rite over him every night up until April.
Wow.
In fact, I read somewhere that he had been baptized while possessed and given Holy Communion even while possessed. Like, they were trying to,
like, really force that demon out.
Like, they're really forcing that demon out here. But it finally ended in April. On this particular night, Roland shouted that, you know, Satan would always be with him. But Father Bodern actually laid out several crucifixes and rosaries and kind of, like, medals and trinkets and stuff on the bed around him, and exclaimed that Saint Michael, who is the patron saint of people suffering from illnesses, would always fight for the boy's soul. Now, it was said that just minutes later after this, Roland came out of his trance and simply said, he's gone.
Oh.
Yeah. He also said that he had a vision that Saint Michael had battled Satan on a large battlefield and vanquished him.
Well, that's a good sign.
Yeah. Now, it was said that after this, all these things the boy had been suffering, all these manifestations, everything, it never happened again. And Roland didn't really remember anything about the possession itself. And he went on to have a normal life afterward.
Okay.
And that was the end of it. Now, this is 1949, and there's a newspaper article written about it, you know, around the town he was from, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of made, like, a big story, but it was like, local boy exercise, you know.
Yeah.
So that's simple. And that was kind of just the end of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But it was years later that an author named Peter Blatty decided to write on the story of Roland. He was inspired by his story. He had connections at Georgetown University, and he was actually able to write to Father Bodern to get information on it.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, Father Bodern agreed to give details on this exorcism only if Peter didn't use the real boy's name, which is why we don't know his name.
Like, okay.
I don't think the Catholic Church even had records of his name just to protect his identity.
Yeah.
So, but since the church, you know, never gave up this name, some have come up with the names of Rolando or Robbie Manheim. Some have even considered a man named Ronald Honkeller, who was an only child living in Cottage City, Maryland, around that same time he would have been.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that maybe this is him. If this is truly him, I mean, one, he's probably well over his 80s now. But he did seem to live a fairly normal life and actually retired after a long career with NASA. So,
okay.
If that's truly him. Back to Peter Blatty. So this novel Peter Blatty published was based on Roland's exorcism. The story went on to spend time on bestseller lists. Very popular. It was also turned into a horror film that would go on to win an Oscar for its screenplay. And that movie and book is The Exorcist.
Okay.
So that's what that's based on. But here's the real question. Was this story of Roland Dole actually true? According to Father Bowden, like, he's quoted as saying, "The case in which I was involved in was the real thing. I had no doubt about it then, and I have no doubt about it now." But plenty of other people have poked holes in this story. In fact, the two priests, Bishop and Bowden, believe that this is true. Halloran, however, he did not give a definitive answer, but it was mostly, "I don't really have a judgment call to make on this one."
Mm-hmm.
Now, the big deal about this is apparently these priests were Jesuits who are known to be more scholarly. They apply scientific rules to their beliefs. You know, if you were going to believe anybody, it would be these priests.
Okay.
So that's kind of where everybody's like, okay, maybe it's real.
Right.
And I mean, what is true is that there was a newspaper article in 1949 that mentioned a boy from Cottage City being exorcised. We do know that that boy from Maryland was brought to St. Louis for treatment for disturbing behavior. We know at least one exorcism was performed based on diary accounts by Father Bowden, who worked with the boy. However, there was an investigation by a man named Mark, and I'm going to say it wrong, Obsasnik, maybe, who say that details in the story were proved false. Now, he questions, like, where this boy was from and whether he was actually taken to Georgetown for treatment first. But these details could have been added in or taken out or whatever just to protect the boy's identity. I mean,
that kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, he was 13, 14 years old. If this was going to be successful, you know, it's not something he would want to live with the rest of his life. I could see them.
Right. I wouldn't want to be known as the possessed kid for the rest of my life.
So I could see them holding back that information or just changing it even a little bit. When he questioned Father Halloran, who was one of the priests there during the exorcism, he said that he wasn't convinced that he heard the boy's voice change into those guttural sounds. He also said that when the marks appeared on the boy's body, you know, the scratches, no one actually checked underneath his nails to see if he'd made the scratches himself.
I feel like that'd be one of the first things I checked.
And you would think, but also, like, I would assume he's restrained.
They couldn't keep him restrained 24/7, though, right?
I don't know.
Hmm.
That I couldn't find out. Obsasnik also discovered that most of the information about the exorcism was based on hearsay and not actually documented, or if it was documented, it wasn't really fact-checked.
Okay.
So there could be details. I mean, I could be even giving you wrong details right now. So
it's like a big, long game of telephone.
Yep. Obsasnik also interviewed neighbors and childhood friends of the boy. Like, they know where this house is in Cottage City.
Oh.
Yeah, like, if you look online, you can find the house, and I can post it on social media even. But apparently he interviewed neighbors and childhood friends, and they all mentioned that Roland had been a, quote, very clever trickster who had pulled pranks to frighten his mother and fool children in the neighborhood.
Oh.
But this went on from January to April? That's quite an elaborate trick.
Maybe he just got too far in. Like,
maybe
it starts out as a prank and then suddenly you're being sent to hospitals. And what do you say? Just kidding. Just kidding, psych. Mom. I didn't mean to cost you all this money and do all this stuff. And like, you got to commit to it at that point, I guess.
Maybe. But then after that, it was like, it was done.
That's maybe it? He learned his lesson.
Maybe. I don't know. Now, Obsasnik believes that the boy was just acting out due to emotional problems, or maybe he had a psychotic episode, which is entirely possible, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is when stuff kind of starts showing up, maybe. But, I mean, he seemed to have led a fairly normal life to begin with. Like, there wasn't a trigger. It could have just been a psychotic break, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, Obsasnik also felt certain that he had actually tracked down the boy, which, of course, was a man now, obviously. When he interviewed that man, he didn't confirm or deny that he was Roland Doe, and he was not interested in the slightest in being interviewed. Like, he didn't want to talk about it.
Okay.
So, was it him? No. But he didn't want anything to do with it.
Gotcha.
So, this also, I mean, this still doesn't prove whether the story was, like, 100% true, or even whether Roland was truly possessed or just suffered from mental illness. I kind of feel like everybody involved in the story saw what they wanted to see. Doctors, a medical point of view, I mean, it's a mental illness. The church, the priest saw it from a religious point of view. It kind of makes it a little hard to prove or disprove anything.
Right.
At this point, it's just a story.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what do you think?
I don't think he was possessed.
You don't think so?
No. But, I mean, I think that there was probably something going on with this kid.
Yeah.
Like, something happened to him. Right. Whether he was faking it or, like you said, having some kind of mental episode or something.
Yeah.
But I think that the people involved believed that they were performing an exorcism, probably.
Yeah, probably.
And then it kind of happens like the fish story, you know?
Yeah.
Caught a fish. It was this big. No, it was this big. No, it was this big.
Right. Also, and it, again, maybe it's because it's been told so many times in different ways over, you know, decades. There's not a lot of proof except for diaries,
mm-hmm.
you know, from these priests. If you want to compare it to other people, Annalise Michelle,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they even had video clips of her voice.
Right.
You know, which I still don't know how I feel about that one. I think it's just the lack of proof.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I'm not feeling this one.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Christina Kettlewell, who was born Christina Machen, was 22 years old in 1947. She worked at a bank in Mimico, Ontario, which is where she lived, and she was in love with a man named John Ray Kettlewell, who went by Jack. Now, Jack was 26 years old, and he was a war veteran. He and Christina had known each other for about 3 years at that point. And when Christina and Jack began talking about marriage, Christina's father opposed it because they were Catholic and Jack was not.
Okay.
Now, Jack actually went through the process of converting to appease her father, but that really didn't make Christina's family feel any better about this marriage. And that's because Jack had a very good friend and business partner named Ronald Berry. Now, Ronald was 28 years old. He had moved from Italy to Canada to get into the construction and insurance business.
Okay.
But it didn't really go very well. He was not successful at it. He was also a professional ballroom dancer.
Nah, it's a little strange.
Yeah. And one of the articles I read from that time period actually also said he was a hairdresser, but I didn't see that anywhere else, so I don't know if he was or not.
Okay.
Ronald was around a lot. Like a whole lot.
Oh. Like creepy a lot?
Like he was almost always with the couple, to the point that Christina's sister actually suspected he was secretly in love with Christina.
Oh, I went the other way with that.
Well, we'll get there. The couple eventually got engaged, and a few days before the wedding, Christina's two sisters went to the boarding house where Ronald and Jack lived to try and talk Christina out of this wedding.
Huh.
And an argument ensued that got so heated that the police were actually called for a disturbance.
Oh, my Lord.
Her sisters kind of told the police, they're like, we don't want our sister to marry this guy. We think mm-hmm. it's a bad idea. Something's going on. And the police were like, I mean, there's nothing we can do. We can't stop her from marrying.
She's an adult.
Yeah, we can't do anything. And her sisters actually claimed that Christina seemed drugged in the days leading up to the wedding, and would later claim that Christina kind of came to from this drug-induced state to learn that she was married.
What?
And then just kind of went along with it.
Oh, okay. Well, my other thought, too, was like, your whole family thinks something's wrong.
Yeah.
But if she was drug-induced, that does kind of make sense, too.
And she was really, really in love with Jack.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to that later. But okay. She really did love him.
Wow. Okay. So what you're saying is she didn't have to be drugged to marry him.
Not really. No.
Okay.
That's not the impression I get. But you'll be able to make your own conclusions.
Okay. Yeah. I'm way ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
On May 12th, 1947, it was actually the day before they were supposed to get married. Christina and Jack eloped.
Okay.
They had a small ceremony with Ronald.
Ronald.
Yep. And a woman named Emma Barger as witnesses.
Okay.
Now, neither Christina or Jack's families knew about the marriage until a few days later when the two finally sent word back to them.
Oh, I bet they were fuming.
So I believe it was 4 days after the marriage that Christina wired, because, you know, it was the 40s.
Yeah.
She wired word back to her family. And then Jack wrote his parents a letter and mailed it to them.
Okay.
After the wedding, Christina, Jack, and Ronald all spent a few days in an apartment together before leaving on May 17th for a remote cabin that Ronald owned.
What a honeymoon.
Yep. He is going on their honeymoon with them.
Uh-huh. Like, is this a throuple situation or like...
Well...
I'm doing it again.
Christina's family was very weirded out by him being on their honeymoon with them.
That's weird.
It is very weird. What are honeymoons for?
Right.
Why would you take your best friend?
There?
Like,
that's so strange.
It freaked everyone out a good bit with, you know, good reason. Now, Ronald's cabin was about 40 miles north from where the couple lived, and it was only accessible by boat.
Ooh. Okay.
Christina's family, like I said, was very unnerved at, like, why is Ronald going on your honeymoon?
Yeah.
But Ronald claimed later that the couple had asked him to go just out of convenience. Like, it's his cabin. He could get them there. He could help with their luggage. It's only accessible by boat. And, you know.
I guess. I don't know.
Now, while they were at the cabin, Christina had apparently begun to act really out of character. Sometimes she would have random crying fits. Other times she would seem completely dazed and just kind of out of it.
Now, who's this information based off or from?
Now, this is from Jack and Ronald later on.
Okay.
Because they were the only ones at this cabin.
Right.
I mean, you can only get there by boat.
Right.
And she also apparently had a few conversations with Ronald about whether or not Jack truly loved her, which seems to be like kind of a repeating theme. You'll see that Christina doesn't feel like Jack loves her as much as she loves him.
Okay.
So I can kind of believe those conversations may have actually happened.
I mean, I can see it. I don't know if I'd talk to my newly wedded husband's best friend about it.
Now,
I don't know.
Christina and Ronald were clearly friends, too. I mean,
yeah.
They all got along, but it's still very strange.
Yeah.
On May 20th, Ronald went out for a few hours in the morning to go sunbathe by the river.
Okay.
And when he returned around noon, he found the cottage on fire. He rushed inside and he found Jack just completely disoriented with a head wound and just burns all over.
Oh, God.
So he drug his friend outside and he went back to search for Christina, but he couldn't find any sign of her. She wasn't in the cottage. She wasn't answering outside. He couldn't find her.
Okay.
So he knew Jack needed to get to a hospital. He was burned. He had a head injury. He had to get him to a hospital. So rather than stay and search for Christina, he loaded Jack up into a boat, took him back to town where he drove him to the hospital.
Uh-huh.
And at the hospital is when they discovered that Jack had also been drugged.
Huh. Did they know from what? Or just he was drugged?
I never found any sources saying what he was drugged
with, yeah.
But there's some suspicions. We'll get to that.
Okay.
Now, it took just an hour for the cottage to completely burn down.
Oh, my God.
Despite attempts to extinguish it. I mean, there were firemen there trying to put it out.
Wow.
But in just an hour, it was gone. But it took several hours for anyone to find Christina. It wasn't until that evening that a man named Neville Sweet, who owned a boathouse nearby, discovered Christina's body on the bank of the Severn River.
Oh.
She was found in 9 inches of water, just 150 feet from the cottage.
Okay.
Now, her body had no signs of burns or violence. Like, nothing had happened to her. It was like she had just walked down to this river and died.
Oh, my God. Okay.
The cause of death was drowning. She drowned in 9 inches of water.
That's weird. That's spooky.
So, on the surface, this case is definitely weird.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's very weird. But it's about to get very complicated.
Oh, good.
Because every new piece of information just, like, raises more questions. And it boils down to there's really only two plausible theories of what happened at this cottage.
Okay.
And there's evidence to support both theories.
Oh, man. Okay. Every time.
After Christina's body was discovered, an autopsy was performed that found traces of codeine in her stomach.
Huh.
Now, codeine is a narcotic, and it's used to treat pain and reduce coughing. Right. And that could be what Jack was drugged with as well.
Okay.
But like I said, I never actually found any sources that knew what he had been drugged with or said what he'd been drugged with.
Okay, right.
But that could also potentially explain how she drowned in only 9 inches of water.
No, that
makes
sense.
If she was drugged, I mean, or took them herself.
Right. It wouldn't take much.
But Christina's family found it very strange that there were no scrapes or injuries or marks on her feet, which you would expect after walking down through thick brush down to the river. Especially if she was under the influence of drugs. She would have been stumbling and tripping. And how would she not have scratched up her feet walking down there? To add to that suspicion, one of the firemen who had been attempting to put out the fire claims that he had gone down to that exact spot to fetch water, and he didn't see her body there at that time. Which, I mean, the fireman, maybe he was mistaken. Maybe he was frantic and just missed it. But
the adrenaline rush and not paying attention. I mean, people walk over bodies.
Yeah. I mean, it happens. I mean,
yeah. When they're looking for them. So, I mean.
Then to make it even more complicated, there were also three suicide notes written by Christina that were turned over to the police.
Okay.
In the first note, which was addressed to Ronald, Christina talks about, quote, the uncertainty of receiving a proposal from Jack. She goes on to say, this will be the best way out, as I cannot bear to see another girl have him.
Uh-huh.
So, basically, this letter was written about 5 weeks before the wedding. It was before his proposal, which is why she's saying, I don't know if he's going to propose. If he's not going to propose, I'm just going to kill myself because I can't stand to see him with another girl.
Right. Who handed over those letters?
Oh, we'll get to that.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Jack later said that he remembered Christina being sick that day. I mean, I guess the letter was dated.
Oh, okay.
And so they asked him about it. And he says, you know, I remember her being sick that day, but I didn't know she'd left a suicide note. I mean, obviously, she didn't kill herself, but I didn't know anything about this. I had no idea.
Huh. Okay.
The second letter was also addressed to Ronald.
Mm-hmm.
And this one came at the end of April. Now, they got married May 12th.
Right.
So this was at the end of April. And in this letter, she explains that it was her intention to kill both Jack and herself via poisoning.
Oh, okay.
She wrote, when you love someone, you really love him. And I know there's no one for me but Jack. And if I cannot have him, I do not intend anyone else to.
Okay.
I waited, as you might say, in the hope that Jack would ask me to marry him, but I now realize I'm just a passing fancy. So she still has not been proposed to. And at this point, she's like, if he's not going to marry me, I'll just take both of us out because I can't stand to see him with anyone else.
Okay. The wheels are turning.
But, obviously.
Yeah.
She didn't go through with it, or it didn't work. Either way, that didn't happen at that time.
Yeah.
The last note was written the day before she died.
Okay.
This one, however, was addressed to Mrs. Thomas, who was a woman who owned a house that Christina and Jack had stayed in for a little while.
Okay, that's
strange. So, like,
strange.
An old landlord, essentially. Yeah. Which, maybe they were closer than that. I mean, I don't really know.
Yeah.
In this one, she says, Ronnie is in the boathouse somewhere. By the time he gets back, everything will be all over with. He must have been afraid something would happen because he's staying an extra day to make sure we go back to Toronto with him. Christina gave the letter to Ronald to mail for her.
Uh-huh.
Now, all of the letters were examined by a handwriting expert, mm-hmm. and it was confirmed that the letters had indeed been written and signed by Christina. They said these are her signature. She signed these letters.
Okay.
However, Ronald never told Jack about a single one of the letters.
Huh.
Jack only found out about these letters during the inquest that was held to determine if there had been foul play involved.
Oh, how convenient.
And, you know, you asked where these letters came from.
Right.
So these letters, Ronald had them at the cottage.
Uh-huh.
And after he saved Jack, he went back inside and got the letters and saved them from the fire.
Okay.
So maybe he suspected Christina and he wanted to get proof that she had done this.
Yeah.
Or maybe he was just looking for a way to shift the blame.
That seems more likely. That's a nice cover up.
But at the same time, these letters are legit. I mean, Christina wrote them.
Maybe it's been a plan the whole time.
I mean, you can't dismiss the letters.
Right.
So, like I said, just more and more questions.
Like, it's clear that she wrote them. They're hers. They're her feelings. But, I don't know. I'm having trouble with that one.
Well, like, there's a lot more to go through.
Very convenient.
So, in a lot of the articles written at the time, I read a lot of old articles that came out right after the situation. I don't know really what to call it.
The event.
And a lot of these articles talk about a large sum of money that was missing that the police were searching for, somewhere between $10,000 and $15,000.
Okay.
A lot of articles would say over $10,000, some would say $12,000. But the point was, that is the 40s. That's a lot of money. So along with the letters, Ronald also had an IOU from Christina written on the day that she died for $15,000.
What? What did she need it for?
So it later came out that Ronald had been loaning Christina money to pay off her blackmailers.
Blackmailers. Okay.
Now, I could not find a credible source on my own about what Christina was being blackmailed for.
Okay.
So I did read on one forum, so I'm not going to say this is true because this is what someone else said they found. I couldn't find it myself. It may not be real.
Okay.
But it's the closest I could get to a legitimate answer.
Okay.
So this person said that Christina had actually been raped by a group of men, and they were demanding money from her in order to not tell her father.
Oh.
Because, you know, in those days, you were used goods. You were never going to get married. It was a big deal. And
what if it was to keep them from telling her husband?
It could have been that too. Hmm. And then that would make more sense on why was she suicidal? Why was she so anxious to get married?
Why was she so worried that he didn't love her?
But like I said, I don't know if that's what she was really being blackmailed about.
No, but that would make sense. Yeah.
And there's no way that Christina ever would have had the money to pay Ronald back. Not $15,000 working at a bank.
Right.
But Ronald told police that he never expected her to pay him back. He said that he gave her that money because they were friends, because he wanted to help her. And he didn't expect that money back.
That's awful friendly. See, this is what... I'm so confused. Like, he's being so conveniently friendly and helpful and... But she's also crazy.
Yep. So, regardless of the reason she was being blackmailed...
Right.
She was actually being blackmailed. This was brought up in article after article that I read about this case from the 40s.
Wow.
So, she seemed to actually be being blackmailed, unless that information is just coming from Ronald, and I don't know if they verified it. I don't know.
Well, now look. I don't know. I've got this personal vendetta against Ronald because it's so weird. But, like, what if he's just like, yeah, I gave her $15,000 because she was being blackmailed, but really, he just wants the police to find him $15,000 so he can have money on top of killing Christina.
Well, that's not a very far-fetched theory. Uh-oh. We'll get to that, though. But at the same time, there was a couple of articles that seemed very contradicting on what was going on with this money.
Okay.
Because there were a few from the time that said Christina had actually somehow paid him back $12,000 already.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't know where she had gotten that money to pay him back. He thought maybe the blackmailers got, like, felt guilty and gave the money back to her, or I don't know, but he claims that she gave it back to him. But then they're also talking about looking for the entire $15,000 and her writing the $15,000 IOU. So did he then give the $12,000 back again? Like, did he give it back to her a second time? Or did she never give it back to him the first time? Or, like,
okay,
there's a lot of confusion with this money.
Yeah. That's weird. Okay.
And like I said, $15,000 would just be a lot of money today. So given all of this evidence, if Christina was being blackmailed, it would only have added to her mental health crisis, especially if she's being blackmailed for the rape reasons that we talked about, especially if it's that. So given this evidence, it's entirely possible that Christina did drug both herself and Jack. She could have hit him over the head in an attempt to knock him out. She could have set the fire, then wandered down to the river in this drug-induced state where she fell in the water and drowned. She maybe passed out in the water. Maybe she was too incapacitated to get up. Or maybe she just didn't want to get up, as she was obviously suicidal.
Right. I mean, yeah. I'm not ruling out the possibility.
It makes a lot of sense.
It does.
But before we really marry that theory, let's talk about Ronald and Jack.
Please do. I need to know all about this.
By June 19th, an inquest had begun to determine whether or not Christina's death involved foul play.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the inquest is held in a courtroom with evidence presented on both sides. It's not a trial.
Right.
But it's like a trial.
Right.
And most of the following information didn't come out until the inquest, when evidence was being presented, which, like I said, is when Jack first heard about the suicide notes. So a lot of this evidence is coming out to Christina's family sitting in this courtroom, Jack and Ronald sitting in this courtroom and hearing about these things for the first time in a courtroom, you know? Now, Jack claimed that he couldn't remember anything about that day past 11 a.m., which at first you're like, okay, yeah, sure, convenient. But realistically, he was drugged and he had a head injury. That's entirely possible that he really does not remember.
Yeah.
Ronald and Jack both, along with 20 other people, were interviewed following Christina's death. Ronald himself was interrogated for 13 hours straight.
Oh, wow.
During which he produced a 3,000-word statement on what had happened, where they were that day, all the events leading up.
Very convenient, Ronald.
Officers even went on record to the press to call this statement fantastic.
Oh, I bet it was.
Which I find super suspicious myself. Like,
I mean,
somewhat, your best friend was almost murdered. His new bride is dead, and you're put together enough to come up with this fantastic statement.
You had all the right
during
words.
A 13-hour interrogation.
Yeah.
Like, he already had all the statements ready, maybe?
That's what I'm wondering.
But maybe he really was just one of those people that can stay calm and just get down to business, turn off that part of his brain.
Hey, man.
I'm trying not to be too biased. I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt because we don't know.
I'm on to you, Ronald.
First and foremost, I want to tell you guys about the insurance policies these two men held.
Always an insurance policy.
Shortly before the wedding, Jack took out two separate life insurance policies on both him and Christina.
Okay.
Both would award $5,000 and both would double in the case of accidental death.
Uh-huh.
Which would leave Jack with a payout that today would be worth about $200,000.
Ooh. But both of them had to have died, right?
No.
Okay. Just accidental.
$5,000 apiece. And wouldn't you know it, the beneficiary on both policies was Ronald.
Shut up.
So that money went to Ronald.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Ronald, he had also taken out a $5,000 insurance policy on his cottage.
Oh, come on.
And the beneficiary on that policy was Jack. It was also revealed during the inquest that Jack had given his war gratuity to Ronald, which is a payment that they receive after being in the war.
Right.
He had given that money to Ronald, and he had cut his entire family out of his will. Another really strange factor that it doesn't really prove a lot, but it was a very weird, kind of conflicting, no one knows what happened thing.
Okay.
And that was Christina's wedding ring. Now, there are varying reports on where the ring came from. Now, some sources say that Ronald bought the ring for the couple.
So, where's all this money Ronald has coming from?
I don't know, because I know he came to Canada from Italy.
Right.
I know he failed in his, you know, construction
and
insurance business, really, which, you know, insurance policies, what a coincidence.
Exactly.
But I don't know where Ronald's money was coming from.
Okay.
But there's also some sources out there that say that the wedding ring actually came from the other witness at the wedding, Emma Barger. I found an article from the time period where they interviewed her, and she claims that she went to the wedding and that the couple didn't have any rings. They didn't have an engagement ring. They didn't have wedding rings.
Huh.
Nothing. So she loaned Christina her own wedding ring to get married with.
Okay.
Because she didn't want her to not have a ring.
No, I mean, that makes sense. But
the problem is, wherever this ring came from, it was never found.
Huh.
It was not on Christina.
Okay.
It wasn't found in, like, the ashes and stuff from the cottage.
Uh-huh.
It was just gone.
Like it could have been pawned.
Possibly.
Or sold.
Now, if Ronald bought this ring, actually,
yeah,
maybe he took it back so he could get his money back.
Right.
But if it really came from Emma Barger, which in the article, she was she wanted her ring back. Apparently, it was worth, like I said, over $1,000, which in today's money, it would be around $13,000 for this wedding ring. And she wanted it back.
Yeah.
She wanted someone to pay for this ring. And that's what that article was about. But did she actually loan it to Christina? Or did she just see an opportunity? That ring's gone. I want some more money. I can say she had my ring. Maybe someone will pay me for it. I don't know.
Wow.
There was another important piece of information that came out at the inquest as well. One that could explain the bizarre relationship between Christina, Jack, and Ronald.
Okay, yes.
During an interview with police, Jack admitted to them that he and Ronald had been involved in an intimate relationship for quite a while.
Okay.
During the inquest, however, Jack denies this relationship, claiming he was coerced by police into saying it because that's what they wanted the narrative to be.
Or he didn't want to say this in front of all his family.
In the 40s. So that fact alone would make a whole lot of things make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. And he could have just been marrying Christina for show.
As a cover up,
which could cause her to question whether he even loved her and her not really know what's going on.
I feel like there's no way she actually knew, or she wouldn't have been writing those letters to Ronald, maybe.
I guess. I don't. I mean, she could have truly loved him and knew the truth and knew it wasn't going to happen.
And maybe she just went along with it. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Wow. This is such a complicated
case. It is. But that makes sense. Why he would be there. Why he was always there.
Why he was giving him money. He was. And I read in several places that Ronald was really the one who kind of orchestrated the whole elopement in the first place. Like, he made this wedding happen.
Huh.
So did the two men set up the marriage as an insurance scam and cover up for their secret affair? Could they have drugged Christina, set a fire, faked the head injury? Well, not fake the head injury, but the head injury, make her look guilty, and then drowned her in the river? But if we go with that theory, then what about the suicide notes? I mean, were they real? Was she forced to write them? Or were they just convenient for Ronald to pull out and use?
I feel like they were a convenience because she wrote them.
Yeah.
They're hers. I think it was convenience.
Ultimately, the inquest was unable to come up with a definitive decision on whether or not foul play was involved.
Yeah.
Which apparently means the case was just not pursued any further.
Ah, the 40s.
That was it.
Yep.
Like, was this a murder? I don't know. Okay, we're done.
Have a great day, guys.
And the story being as big as it was at the time, because it was a big story, led to some really weird following cult thing happening with this case. I don't know if cult's the right word, but like, people would line up outside the courthouse. I mean, it was packed every day anyway.
Well, yeah.
People would line up outside the courthouse to get Jack and Ronald's autographs.
What?
Yeah.
That's strange.
3 years after Christina's death, Jack remarried and started a family in the same house he once shared with Christina.
Oh.
And eventually he moved his family across the street. And after he passed away, his son Richard and his wife lived in that house. They may still live there. The last article I saw was from 2017.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if they still do or not, but at that point they did.
Yeah.
But Jack never told his children about Christina.
Huh.
In fact, they didn't find out about the whole thing until his daughter Sharon came across some articles about it while researching family history at the library.
Oh, no.
And she didn't find those articles until 1992.
Wow.
By that time, Jack was already older. He was in declining health. And they decided to just not bring it up with him. So they never asked him about it.
Dad.
Right?
I don't know if I could keep my mouth shut.
I would have had to have asked him. But, I mean, maybe declining health actually means he was in early stage dementia.
That's true.
I don't know. But Jack passed away in 1998.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Ronald kept in contact with Jack for some time after the incident.
Yeah.
Before moving to New York in 1956. He left behind a Pekingese dog named Ling for Jack's then 2-year-old son, Richard. And the family never heard from him again.
Huh.
Like, he just disappeared.
That is weird.
Moved to New York and was just gone.
Well, I'm sure you could hide better in New York.
To this day, no one really knows what happened to Christina, who became known as the 8-Day Bride. Was she suffering from a mental health crisis and she took her own life after attempting to take her husband's? Or was she set up and murdered by her new husband and his secret lover for the insurance money?
What if it was just a complete, it was just a rough day for everybody?
Right.
Like maybe it was just like everything coming together and the planets aligned. She freaked out. Maybe she found out about him.
But then there's no signs of violence on her body. Like I said, she was not injured.
That's the weird part.
She was not forced into that water. She was not hurt in any way. She was just laying face down in 9 inches of water where she drowned. But she definitely had drugs in her system, did Jack. And she had threatened in her note from April to poison both of them.
Maybe Ronald tried to get rid of both of them.
Maybe, but he's the one who saved Jack. He could have claimed he just didn't make it back in time, and Jack was already dead. But if he was in love with him, I mean, if they were together, maybe he couldn't go through with it, or maybe that was his plan the whole time. Get rid of Christina. I'll have Jack all to myself.
That's true. But then why leave? Unless, who knows? Maybe they were together, and maybe he was like, he saved him, and that was the whole plan. And then Jack was like, I got to go get married.
I mean, yeah, Jack did get remarried just a few years after. And
maybe that hurt him, and he moved on.
But I don't know.
That's so weird.
So let us know what you think. Did Christina kill herself, or was she murdered by her new husband and his possible lover?
Or just Ronald. Ronald, Bud.
It could have been all orchestrated by Ronald. He could have been the sole perpetrator. But then the insurance money, if you go with that theory, Jack took out just as many, more insurance policies than Ronald did.
Sure. Oh, who knows? Oh, man, that's a weird one. I'm going to be thinking about that one for a while. Thanks for listening.
Like us on Facebook at True Crimes and Weird Times Podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at True Crimes Weird Times.
Email us your stories at truecrimesweirdtimes@gmail.com.
Can't wait for the next episode? Check out our Patreon for bonus episodes and more.
And if you enjoyed the show, make sure to subscribe and leave a review.
Bye!